Hello, Coffee House Shops listeners. My name is Freddie Gray, and I edit The Spectator's US edition. I know you're all huge Westminster enthusiasts, but Brexit is over, and the big story of 2020 is going to be the American election. So I would like to urge you all to listen to my Americano podcast, where we discuss everything that's going on in Trump world and Democrat world. If you go to spectator.co.uk/Americano, you can listen to it all.
Welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. Boris Johnson's going to reshuffle his government on Thursday next week. We're led to believe it's going to be a pretty significant reshuffle, and he intends to actually let people keep their jobs for quite a few years, thereby setting in clay what his first term in Parliament will look like. I'm Fraser Nelson, and I'm joined by Katie Bowles and James Forsyth to discuss. Now, Katie, right at the start of this year, you were talking about a Valentine's Day massacre. We're going to get this a little bit before Valentine's Day, but will it be a massacre?
Well, since then, I think it's begun to seem as though it will have fewer fatalities than we first expected. James used the term midsummer murders, but the issue there is also quite a lot of people die in those episodes. I think when it comes to how many people are going to be kicked out of cabinet, we are expecting some secretaries of state to lose their role. Initially, when this was first written up straight after the election result, there is this sense that it would be a big Whitehall shake-up that accompanied it and some departments would completely go. And there was a general sense that, partly, I think, because Boris Johnson doesn't like meetings that run on and on and on, you would end up with fewer people sitting around the cabinet table. Now, I think there will be some reorganisation, as James revealed. You are going to see Difford folded into the Foreign Office. But I don't think it is going to be quite as dramatic. That said, I think that if you speak to figures in this government, number 10, there is the sense that this is a good opportunity to bring in some new talent and get rid of, I suppose, a few faces that are too much reminded of the old regime and aren't bringing that much more to the table in their view. So you're going to see some regular faces go. But I think the other thing to look out for is how these junior ministerial appointments work out, because there are lots in the new intake or recent intakes, and I think particularly in terms of women, which they want to put on the fast track to promotion, partly so Boris Johnson isn't told that his government is not pro-women.
Now, James, the British cabinet is pretty big. There are 33 members. Now, that compares to 16 in the United States and, I think, 15 in the German Bundeskabinet. So our cabinet is twice the size, right? Oh. Now, why should this continue? If you're Boris Johnson and you want to do radical reform of Whitehall, wouldn't you think, look, this has just become too big? It's time to cut in half, because if America can do it with half the number of people, then so can Britain.
Patronage is the simple answer to that question. If you halve the number of positions around the cabinet table, you essentially halve the Prime Minister's most valuable currency, patronage, in terms of managing his parliamentary party.
But does he need it? With this majority, he doesn't need to be begging favours from...
It is tempting to do that argument, but I don't think it's quite right. Let's say you did halve it. 16 people who lost their positions around the cabinet table, right? That's potential trouble. And as you can see on the Huawei issue, you've got a whole bunch of people who, you know, who are not worried about rebelling because their careers are behind them. You know, David Davis and Damian Green aren't expecting a recall to the colours. I'm not saying they're going to rebel against the government on Huawei, but they're quite happy to make trouble on the issue. And they're genuine concerns about it because, you know, they are not interested. And so I think that is one of the other reasons why. I also think the other reasons why is, you know, it would be wrong to really think that we've had cabinet government for quite some time. The kind of the much more action happens in these cabinet committees that are much smaller cast list than in the cabinet itself. Now, I think Katie is right that Boris Johnson would like a smaller cabinet. He doesn't like meetings that go on. I'm told that when you have these kind of conference call cabinet discussions, if there's something on the weekend that the Prime Minister needs to update the cabinet on, it's quite clear that he wants to kind of get off the phone as fast as possible. But I think it would be a very self-denying Prime Minister who would who would hugely reduce their powers of patronage. I mean, we're not quite at the David Cameron, Nick Clegg stage when they were kind of adding kind of little kind of picnic tables to the end of a cabinet table to fit everyone around it. But I still think a kind of massive reduction in the size of a cabinet is unlikely to happen. I think what is instead is what will continue is, you know, things like the strategy for the Brexit talks, the actual the EU-UK trade negotiation, I should say, actually taking place in smaller cabinet committee meetings. Or, you know, for example, Cabinet will discuss HS2 next week, but I think it is a reasonable assumption to say that that decision has already been taken in smaller meetings before it comes to the Cabinet.
Now, Casey, the Prime Minister said recently that he believes in Cabinet government. Now, when a Prime Minister says that, what it's taken to mean is that I'm not going to be a command and control dictator at number 10. I'm going to allow my education secretary to have freedom of reign to do what he wants with education, he reports to me, as opposed to the Blairite kind of Napoleonic model, where number 10 was very much in control. This seems to square rather badly with his behaviour so far, because number 10 has seemed like it wants to be very much in control. And take the special advisers, right? They are they work to cabinet members, but every week they're summoned in front of Dominic Cummings and told what they can and can't do, who they can and can't have lunch with. So it seems that number 10 is so far showing that it does want quite a central hold over this government.
I think it depends how you define this issue, but it's very clear that this number 10 wants to have centralised power. I think even before they had a majority of 80, they took several important steps to try and bring back control to number 10. I don't think it is the case that cabinet ministers have that much control of their general agenda. That is coming directly from number 10. However, I think there is a difference in terms of Boris Johnson is happy to have cabinet ministers represent certain issues. He is very happy for Dominic Raab, for example, to be the face in the Commons, in the chamber, of lots of the Brexit issues. I don't think he feels the need to be front and centre. Also, it's the case that if they trust a cabinet minister, and I don't actually think there's that many current cabinet ministers number 10 do really trust, but if they trust a cabinet minister, such as I think Dominic Raab, when you had the case of the girl who was embroiled in a rape case in Cyprus and charged from that, they were happy for Dominic Raab to take the lead on this because they trusted him and therefore to do all the media that accompanied it. So I think there's a sense that some cabinet ministers can take leading roles within their department, but I think when it comes to the general agenda and the policies, that's firmly coming from number 10 and that's not going to change. And again, these cabinet meetings, I don't think are where the big issues are really being crunched out. So I don't think it is really true that this is a, you know, government-free cabinet in the original definition people would think of it. But there are ways, I think, that Boris Johnson doesn't want to make it all about him, and some things are being divvied out to them, but no, they don't have that much control.
Now, James, when we're told what criteria number 10 are looking for here, we hear things like being quiet in cabinet meetings, not thinking out of your box, being obedient. And it's reminded me of an old spitting image sketch of Margaret Thatcher, which we're going to play now.
Would you like to order, sir?
Yes. I will have a steak.
How'd you like it?
Oh, raw, please.
And what about the vegetables?
Oh, they'll have the same as me.
So could it be that this reshuffle, James, is Boris Johnson looking to recruit a cabinet of vegetables?
No, I don't think so, because I think they are prepared to let ministers have their heads if, as Casey said, if they've got an agenda that number 10 thinks can work. I mean, if you look at kind of Robert Jenrick and planning reform, for example, I mean, that's kind of an interesting example of where they are quite happy to let a Secretary of State take the lead because they are think they are there. I also think, as Casey said, he doesn't want to be in front of the cameras on every issue. So I think if you think back to every previous Prime Minister, from certainly from Margaret Thatcher onwards, they would have been the face of the UK's response to the Iran crisis that followed the US deciding to kill Soleimani, the leader of the Al-Quds force. Yet Boris Johnson himself was quite happy to let Ben Wallace do it in the Commons, you know, that the Defence Secretary do it in the Commons, and that to be the face of the crisis. I think that is the difference. And I think, you know, if you look at how they are going to do it, it is that kind of thing which will be different. I think there is an interesting question about how I think you have seen a lot of ministers in, because normally this is, so the other thing we should say about this reshuffle is unusual in that this is essentially the post-election reshuffle, which is normally done the day after the election. Mm-hmm. But because Boris Johnson wanted to get, you know, the Brexit legislation through before he did it and have time to think about how he wanted to change the way the government worked, there has been this period of time that has elapsed. And in that period of time, a lot of ministers have wanted to show number 10 that basically we will get on with what you want to do. And so that has, I think, one of the things that is kind of pulled the sides of the reshuffle back. The other thing to look at in this reshuffle, which is a perennial Tory problem, is the pipeline issue, as it's called. There is a feeling that they want to promote, that they don't want to see the number of women in the cabinet drop precipitously, yet they worry that they don't have the women at the Minister of State level who they would want to promote to cabinet. So I think look in this reshuffle to see lots of women being bumped up to that Minister of State level in the hope that when they next do a reshuffle towards the end of this year, those people can be promoted into the cabinet too.
And I think when you're looking at who is tipped for big promotion, there are some secretaries of state, I think, so tempting fate here, but Andrea Leadsom, Theresa Villiers, I don't think are really seen as the future. And I think there is a sense that if they were to keep their jobs, that would be surprising. But when it comes to ministers who look destined for promotion, I think that you go back to the leadership campaign, and it now feels as though Boris Johnson was always going to win that leadership campaign. But actually, the point when Boris Johnson and his team things started to turn in their favour was a Times op-ed written by Rishi Sunak, Robert Jenrick and Oliver Dowden. And that was the point when they managed to get a lot more MPs on side after, because those three Tory MPs...
Who were seen to be the future.
Yeah, they were seen to be the future. They weren't seen to take a hardline position on Brexit particularly. They were seen to be pragmatic and rising stars. And when they came out and backed Boris Johnson, it's that point, if you speak to members of Boris Johnson's leadership campaign, that they say it started to look like it was his to lose. And I think that you've seen in the general behaviour towards those three people, that those are three people you can expect to either stay in very good jobs. I think Robert Jenrick's promotion to DCLG secretary surprised them because it was a quick promotion, but to either stay in good jobs or be promoted in this reshuffle, because they're seen as, I think, if you're going to say people of the old regime, these are definitely seen to be politicians of the new regime.
And James, do you think that they will be left for some time? David Cameron was quite good, actually, in not doing too many reshuffles. But if you look at since 1997, this country has had something like 18 housing ministers, 15 Department of Work and Pensions secretaries, 10 Scotland secretaries. The average cabinet member in Britain is lucky to last 2 years. And in Germany, I think it's 3 years. In America, it's more. So do you think Boris will be able to resist the urge to tinker with this? Because it seems to me, by the way, that he hasn't actually got much of a plan in general right now. So when he does this reshuffle, I don't think we're going to see the shape of Boris Johnson's plan. My hunch is he's going to arrive at his plan for government in about a year's time and will probably reshuffle again.
I mean, so the thing firstly I would say is events, my dear boy, events. I mean, most reshuffles do not occur because the Prime Minister decides they want to have a reshuffle. They occur because someone gets in trouble and has to resign, or someone quits the government.
Texting teenagers.
Indeed. And so I think that is the first thing to bear in mind. I mean, the second thing to bear in mind is the reason I would expect another reshuffle in the not too distant future is I think that there is this pipeline issue. I think there are some people that they would like to get up to cabinet, but it's too much of a leap to send them all the way to the cabinet table right now. So, you know, pipeline, all that stuff. But you are undoubtedly right that when you look at some of these jobs, the turnover of prisons ministers, of housing ministers, of welfare, work and pensions secretaries of state, you know, they are inherently disruptive. And, you know, there is an interesting question, for example, by the time that universal credit is finally actually rolled out, you know, how many secretaries of state will have overseen one part of its implementation? And it will be a huge number. And I mean, that is a challenge. I also think that, you know, one of the things to watch for, which is, I think in the junior ministerial ranks, there'll be a lot of change. Because I think the essential test being applied is, in 5 years, at the end of this parliament, can we imagine this person in the cabinet, yay or nay? And if the answer is nay, these people will ship out. Now, there will be some exceptional technicians, people who are particularly good and particularly well suited to a particular junior ministerial job, who will survive. They will be the exceptions that prove the rule. But, I mean, that is the general approach that they are going to take.
Well, let's see how the cards fall next week. James and Getty, thanks very much indeed. You can subscribe to this podcast, Coffee House Shots, on the iTunes store. You can also rate and review us. And if you do have time, then do put some words off review. We love reading them. Well, almost all of them. Some of them are pretty rude, actually. But most of them are quite nice. We read everyone. So if you do have a time, then please do it. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our producer, Cindy Yu. And if you'd like to work for Cindy, we're recruiting a podcast deputy editor right now. You can see job details on spectator.co.uk/podcast job.